CM. CM, not Claire. Claire Elizabeth, CM.
Okay, we're going to call to order the meeting of the Airport Committee for April 12th, 2022, and we'll begin with the roll call. I'm Ralph Busby, and I'll be filling in for Jeff Bertolite, who's absent today.
Mark Watkins.
Susan Painter.
Pete Mark Opel.
Lance Vanderbeck.
Dan McRae.
Dan Brown.
Okay, and we have from the city, we have Peggy Hawker and David Allen. And so we'll begin with the approval of the minutes from the last meeting. Does anyone want to make a motion to approve the minutes?
I'll make a motion to approve, Chairman.
All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, minutes have been approved. Okay, the first thing on the agenda is committee orientation training. Is that you, Peggy?
That's David and I are tag teaming on that.
All right.
You're ready.
Go right ahead.
We will launch. So one of the things that David and I are doing before I leave is we're meeting up with all the city standing committees and just running through the a very quick orientation that covers a few things. Today we're going to talk about how the airport committee was created, the duties of the committee, public meetings, public records, and ethics. And please feel free to ask questions at any point. And David and I will share the discussion.
Okay.
So is this, okay, there it is. So I just told you what we're gonna talk about. So the airport committee was created by an ordinance, and it is, if you want to see it, it is included in the municipal code. It talks about who the airport committee consists of, which is 7 full members, but the mayor, the city manager, and the airport director can serve as ex officio non-voting members, although they don't have to attend. Only full members, which are the people here and the people who are on Zoom right now, can be counted toward a quorum. So the duties of the airport committee are included here. It just says that you have the authority and responsibility to recommend rules and regulations for the airport, recommend policies for the airport property, and review and report to the council on matters referred to this committee by the council, and make studies or reports related to the airport and promote the airport. So I know that that's a regular part of your responsibilities and that you do it all the time. Anything follow up from you, David?
No, other than this committee is important for making recommendations up to the city council as far as airport related uses and how the airport's operated. So that's the reason why we have your committee, because you provide that input and recommendations when necessary.
So break in if you have questions. Does anybody have anything so far? Jim? I
hey,
think
Jim,
it was related to the design of one of the hangars, or was it both of them? Both of them. So the city council approved the lease, and it's coming back to you for approval for design.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's on the agenda. There's the last item on the agenda, and I think it's going to take some extensive discussion. And David, you may want to stay around for this.
I'll see. Well, we'll see.
In fact, I guess we could move it up if you got a schedule issue, because I think it'd be in your interest to be here also.
All I would say is the staff developed a hangar timelines/checklist, which goes through the different procedures, and that kind of is one of the components of it, is your review of the design and after the lease has been approved. So yeah, you're now taking over the...
Yeah, that's what we want to discuss, because I don't know about the other people, but I...
About the checklist and...
Yeah, I got some serious issues with some of the stuff that's in there.
We'll talk about it later, okay. I don't want to take up time on this orientation for that, but
Not part of this agenda item, I appreciate that.
Okay.
Anyway, go ahead.
Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit about public meetings, and there are a couple types of public meetings that could apply to this particular committee and other standing committees. There are your regular meetings like you're having today, and also if you needed to develop a subcommittee. Although I would tell you that if you develop a subcommittee, you're going to be subject to public meeting laws. Have I gone haywire, David?
No, I don't think this committee has actually gone through the subcommittee process.
Well, they certainly have a long time ago, because they had a subcommittee to work on...
I'm talking about this current group.
Not the current
group. Yeah, so if you do have a subcommittee, what happens typically, and this is something that comes up periodically, is you are 7 members, a quorum is 4. So typically, if there's 4 or more, you don't want to be meeting unless it's a noticed public meeting. But you can, as a governing body, meaning as a committee, develop a subcommittee of 3 people of your group, a subgroup. If you do that formally and that subgroup of 3 meets, it may not be a quorum of the total group, but by creating a subgroup, that's going to make a recommendation up to your full committee. You have created a group or a governing body, so to speak, that is now subject to the public meetings law, even though there's only 3 of you. It just depends on how, you know, the formal process you would utilize to create that subgroup. So that's always something to keep in mind. And Lance, being our staff member, if that did come up, he would want to check with me just to make sure that what you've done is appropriate in creating a subgroup, in case we actually have to go through a public noticed type of situation with that smaller subgroup of perhaps 3 of your committee members.
So generally, all of our standing committees are required to provide notice. And by notice, I mean you have to put your agendas out to the public. And what the staff does is once we publish an agenda, we make sure it goes to the press. It's posted in 3 different locations, and it's also posted on our website. And so your meetings have to be held in an appropriate space and location. And right now, that space and location is this room. And the reason for that is this is the only facility we have at this point where we can push your meetings out to the public on the city's live stream and also on Charter Channel 190.
Are those 2 media representatives required to have a public meeting?
What 2 media?
Well, to have it live stream. Let's say we want to have a meeting.
No, it's not a requirement, but here's what happened. When we were in the throes of COVID, people became accustomed to being able to watch our meetings. And they, you know, we've heard from plenty of people that they enjoy seeing our committee meetings, not just council, but committee meetings. And so it's just a policy decision on the part of the city that we'll continue having all of our meetings in this room. There may come a time when, you know, we get beyond this and perhaps we'll have some additional equipment that would allow you to meet in another place. But right now, this is the only room in which we can push a public, you know, a public access channel television
and live stream too.
Out and the live stream out to the public. This is the only space because it operates off of all of this pretty sophisticated
equipment. So it wouldn't be recommended if we wanted to, say, go down to Lance's FBO and have a meeting down there because we wanted to talk business or talk over, it would not be recommended to have a meeting, a public meeting, other than this facility?
Yes, that's right. We're having all of our meetings in here right now. All of our public advisory committee meetings, standing committees, are meeting in here. I know that, you know, this is a departure from what we were doing before when we were meeting in, for example, Conference Room A, or if, you know, the library used to meet in the McEntee Room at the library, and 60 plus met at that facility, and Parks and Rec met over there, but now we're all in here. So
this is the only place we can get Zoom to Zoom signal in for people who may want to attend a meeting by Zoom.
The other thing is, Mark, back, you remember with Conference Room A, we just had the audio file. But now, you know, with this, folks can at least watch. And sometimes it's, you know, I mean, the audio file's fine with me, but some folks actually like to see what's going on and actually have the video. So this provides that when it's being live streamed and recorded, they can just go to the committee webpage and link on and they'll see everyone. So, I mean, there's a benefit to it. I think we've learned over the past couple of years.
What are your thoughts, Mark?
I'm sorry?
What are your thoughts about the meeting?
Well, my thought is I'm pro public governance. And the more ears and eyes we have on all committees and all public meetings, I encourage it. So I just want to make sure that's not a new civil code that we're enacting. It's just it's recommended that we have it here. And I encourage it, Dietmar, because again, we're going to have more of the public involved on an easier level. You know, people that aren't mobile. Now they have an opportunity to tune in to your council meetings and to the airport meeting and everything else that's going on. So I just wanted to clarify if it was a new civic code or civil code or something that's just highly recommended.
It's not a code, it's just our policy. So, and it really, I mean, you would be astonished at the number of people we've had communicate with us and say, we really are thankful that you are televising these or putting it on your live stream, and you can go back and see, as David said, any one of them. So the next thing we'll talk about briefly is the agenda. So agendas have to contain enough information so that the public can look at the agenda and tell what you're really going to be talking about. Back in the day, we used to have agendas that said new business, old business, and no one knew what was going to be discussed. And so that's why we've sort of dispensed with the new business, old business. David?
The only thing I would add is, you know, when you put out an agenda, and this is, you know, what the council's always very aware of, is you want to make sure that if you know you're going to be speaking about an issue or there's an item, you get it on the agenda. And really, the only time you want to add an item to the agenda, it's if it wasn't, you know, something you were aware of at the time the agenda was posted 3 or 4 days earlier. Now, there's a process the council has for adding new agenda items at the time of the meeting, which is they need at least 75% or more of the council members voting to add it to the agenda, and that's typically not an issue. Usually a council member or typically Spencer or another staff person just had something last minute. The one thing that I would probably say is, and that's kind of a formal process, but the one thing that I've seen with committees is you have your items listed on the agenda, and then you get to like committee comments where the committee starts talking. And then all of a sudden, out of those comments comes some discussion item and a motion and some vote. Now, that's not been on the agenda. No one's aware of it until the time it comes up during the committee discussion. I would probably say that's probably not consistent with what we're trying to do when we post agendas. I really think, you know, this is just my view based on how we want to operate is, if you got an agenda item that you really need to get on the agenda, but there wasn't time to do it, you know, bring it up at the time of the meeting, at the beginning of the meeting, and see if everyone's comfortable. You know, we have a process at the council level, but, you know, if a majority are comfortable putting on the agenda, you add it as an agenda item. But those really should only be reserved for times in which you really weren't aware of that being an item 3 or 4 days earlier. What I would probably refrain from is, when you get to the end of the meeting and you start having your committee discussion, you're all of a sudden adding items to the agenda with votes and motions and whatever. That actually is probably not a really good process. And I think that probably should be minimized to the extent possible, because it really is not complying with what the intent is of having agendas posted online and following those agendas during the course of the meeting.
Yeah, and one of the things that you'll notice about our agendas for standing committees and city council is that many of the agenda items have supporting documentation attached to them, and so when you look at it online, you can just click on the blue link and it pops it right up. So that really helps the public to understand what it is you're about to discuss, and actually helps you.
I would say one thing, though. And this is really important for committee I know the committee only meets once a month. Council meets twice a month, so it's a little easier to get stuff on the agenda. But if something comes up at the end, let's say you're having your committee comments at the end of the meeting, you're discussing stuff, and something comes up that you really want to talk about, either What you may want to do is just, if it's not pressing, just have it scheduled as a next meeting agenda item and actually have Lance as a staff member prepare a report, or he'll consult with us. That way you get it on the agenda formally, and if there's any underlying documentation that's necessary to help reach a recommendation on that issue, it can be posted on the agenda as well as one of these supporting materials.
So the next thing we'll talk about is public attendance. So the Oregon public meeting law is a public attendance law, not a public participation law. So there's no inherent right for the public to offer testimony at one of your meetings. But the city's policy has been to include an agenda item for public comment on all of our agendas. And it's been just the practice of the city to include that. And you know, the chair has the right to control the meeting. So if a person would be making public comment and out of control, you just, you know, the chair can handle that short of, you know, short of any violence.
I would say that for your committee, it's not an issue, but some committees and commissions, like the Planning Commission, the City Council, the Budget Committee, there are, as you know, many of you know, there are certain times in which the public is required or has the ability and the right to speak. Now, for your committee, I don't think there's really any issue that ever comes up before you that, you know, requires you to actually solicit public comment, but as we know, as a matter of just what we've been doing over the past decades, is you allow it because it's the right thing to do. It provides transparency and it makes sure that the public has a right to participate, even if they're not even though if it's not a requirement, we're basically allowing it to happen because we feel it's the right thing to do as far as just that overall public participation and transparency in the issues that we consider and decide upon.
On that item, timing, the time that is allowed per person to speak, should the committee indicate that at the start of the meeting?
Yeah, I'm not sure what's on, I have the agenda right here. Is there any time, I know we limit obviously at the council level because we get, you know, there's actually, I don't think there's anything in code or in your committee rules or whatever that talk about time limits. I would probably say we usually allow 3 minutes at the council level, and that's probably just a good kind of time frame. I mean, if there's only one person speaking and they want to go beyond 3 minutes, I mean, there's nothing that would prevent you. But sometimes at the council level, there's like 5 or 6 people, and you want to keep it moving along, so you allow 3 minutes. But at your committee level, if someone shows up at the end, they want to say something, it's really up to the chair as to how long they want to let them speak and, you know, how much time is left before your meeting ends.
Right, and again, the chair has the authority, so you can, you can sort of play that by ear, fortunately.
Yeah. I've been on committee meetings where the public has droned on and on about the same thing, you know, for 20 minutes, and pretty soon it gets boring.
Yeah, that I would say that's probably a good, the chair, you know, sometimes a chair of a committee needs to kind of put those sideboards on to make sure people understand how much time they have to speak.
All right, so the next thing we'll talk about is voting at meetings. Whenever you take any official actions at a meeting, it has to be done publicly. So, and the votes have to be recorded in the minutes, and secret ballots are prohibited. So one of the things that happens is, for example, if you were going to be interviewing 5 candidates for 2 vacancies on this committee, a number of committees find it really uncomfortable to have to make a decision out loud. You can have a written paper ballot, but that would have to be read aloud by the staff person, you know, each person's vote. For example, Lance voted for these 2 people to fill the vacancies. Mark voted for these 2. So it has to be allowed, so it's not ever going to be a secret ballot. So I don't know if you have come up against that. I know a couple other committees have felt really uncomfortable when they've had to make those decisions, and they have not wanted to do it. But when they found out they had to read them anyway, they just decided, what the heck? So the next thing is, because Lance prepares your agenda and packet well in advance, and he attaches a lot of supporting documentation to the packet, it just is incumbent really upon you to read that before you come to the meeting. And also our meeting materials are typically available and posted on our website at least 3 days before the meeting. David?
No.
I can hear you buzzing.
No. That,
okay,
I'm
then.
Good with that one.
Minutes. So minutes have to be taken at all meetings, and they really only have to reflect who's present, the motions, proposals, and any measures that are proposed, the results of all votes, the substance of any discussion. It can be very brief, reference to any document discussed. And so if, for example, somebody came into one of your meetings and distributed a document to all of you and you referenced that during the meeting, that document would ultimately have to be attached to our electronic packet. We don't really see that happen very much, but it does. Minutes are not verbatim transcripts. Thank goodness. We used to have a person who did minutes for us. We had a contractor who prepared minutes for our various standing committees in the city council. He got a real job. So now it's on us again. So bear with us.
Peggy was doing minutes for many years until just a few years ago.
About 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And so, yes, so anyway.
You've been doing it.
I think that, you know, honestly, I think that when my successor comes, he actually prepares a different kind of minutes in his municipality. He does what I would consider to be action minutes, which just basically shows what the item is and the vote, the motion and the vote. And I don't know if that will ultimately be what happens here, but it could be, especially with the number of committees that we have to staff and the time involved in preparing minutes. So anyway, we're gonna briefly talk about public records. We're almost through, we only have 6 slides left. So what is a public record? It is any information, regardless of its physical form, relating to the conduct of the public's business. And it's prepared, owned, used, or retained by a public body. And one example of that is, hopefully you're not doing this, but if you are all sitting up there texting each other about when is she gonna be through with this orientation,
they're doing that right now. I
know.
See them texting.
Those are public records, and we're gonna be
doing it.
We're gonna be making a public records request for that information pretty quickly here.
No, they're saying, when's David leaving the room? That's what they're saying.
We in the city, we have a public records policy.
I saw that.
Just so you know, any person has a right to inspect any non-exempt public record of the city or any public body in Oregon. And it's a disclosure law rather than a confidentiality law. And when I get a public records request, it doesn't matter to me who it is and why they want it and whether they need it. It just doesn't matter. We, you know, we have a policy here and we have to adhere to it. And if it's not exempt, then we have to provide it. And these are some examples of public records that we have in the past been asked to produce. Text messages, see it? You know, when we started to do Zoom meetings, that was kind of alarming because you have the chat feature. And the chat feature, if you're chatting in the chat feature, you're creating a public record if you're in a public meeting. I finally figured out how to turn that off. Not soon enough. The next thing we'll talk about is the public records request policy. I already told you that we have a policy, and we have in our policy, we have 3 levels of public records requests. Level 1 is really a simple request, and it goes to the department typically that houses the records. Any level 2 or level 3 records request comes to my office, and then we sort of figure out who's got the records, if they've got the records, and how much it costs to produce the records, because we have the ability to charge, and we charge actual costs for those. So then we're going to talk about ethics, and this is where David is.
Well,
he loves to talk about this. So, okay, David,
okay.
You're on.
Well, the first thing is I'm actually referring to a document that, Lance, did you pass it out, or do they have a copy of
they
it?
They do.
Okay. Now, last year, the Oregon Government Ethics Commission did update their guide for public officials on the Oregon Government Ethics Law. For a while, it was like 12 years old, and they had supplements, and it was difficult tracking it, things. So as of April of last year, they finally updated it. You know, there's a lot to the ethics law. There's, you know, gifts, conflicts of interest, the but-for test as far as using your position for, you know, that no one else will be able to access something, but you can because of your position or office. But I was just thinking what probably is most pertinent to this group. And, you know, there's probably a couple things, but I think primarily since, you know, the focus of this group is meeting once a month and making recommendations. You don't make final decisions. Now, there, other than the council, once in a while, the Planning Commission makes a final decision, unless it's appealed. And, you know, the Budget Committee doesn't make final decisions, but they approve a budget that then goes up to the council for adoption. But for your purposes and for most of the standing committees, with those couple of exceptions, you're really here to make recommendations to the council or city staff, depending on the issue. So, and that pertains then to the conflicts of interest requirements. And that starts on page 11 of the handout. But, you know, for your purposes, since you're not making a final decision, you're only recommending, the only thing that really you should be cognizant of as committee members is potential conflicts of interest. Because actual conflicts of interest only occurs if you're making a decision, and by doing that, something will benefit you or be to your detriment. If you're only making recommendations, it could, because perhaps the council may not agree with you and do something differently. So for your purposes, if an issue comes up before you as an action or agenda item that you believe because of, you know, your involvement at the airport, whether you lease or own a hangar or whatever, if you think that decision could somehow potentially impact you financially, either as a benefit or a detriment, and those issues probably come up periodically. You review leases, you review the rates that are charged, and, you know, some of your dealings for some of you on the committee, that might, you know, be something that financially could impact you one way or another. When that occurs, what you need to do is just say, look, I have a potential conflict of interest for this item because, and just state the reason why you think you have a potential conflict of interest, whatever the item is. But you would obviously say, you know, we're only making a recommendation, so this only could benefit me. It's not a certainty. So by declaring the potential conflict of interest at the beginning of the meeting and every subsequent meeting in which that item comes up, that's all you need to do. You can now continue to talk about the item, you can vote on the item, and you can make a decision or a recommendation. Now, with an actual conflict of interest, you'd have to recuse yourself entirely. But if it's a potential conflict of interest, just get it on the record and continue with your deliberation and vote. And that protects you, and it's consistent with what's required under the Oregon Government Ethics Law. So for your committee, I think that's really the one issue that comes up. And, you know, a handful of you, obviously, probably need to be cognizant of that when those items come up and just make sure you declare it before the item's discussed and a vote is taken for a recommendation.
Any questions? Because
and one final thing, I would really recommend, because this helps me, is this is kind of what I always refer to. This is the guide for public officials. If I have a question, the other thing that's really worthwhile is, and this applies to you as committee members, it applies to council members, planning commission members. There's a number in this handout for the Government Ethics Commission. They have staff that, and the staff's responsibility, one of their responsibilities is to interact with public officials who have questions. So you can pick up the phone and call a staff person at the Oregon Government Ethics Commission and say, look, I think I may have an issue here for myself. An ethics issue, conflict of interest, and they will help guide you through it. But they really like you to call them before you've taken action rather than afterwards. It's like, be preemptive and call them ahead of time. Don't wait until it's over with and say, oh, maybe I should call them and find out what's going on. Call them ahead of time because then they can provide you guidance and help you through that process and give you more direction. So I've done that in the past when I was a council member. Sometimes if I have a question, even as a city attorney, I call them because they know this stuff better than I do, because this is all they do 24/7. And they're a great resource, and it's free. We pay for it through our taxes. they're a state agency, and utilize them if necessary, because I think it's worthwhile if the issue ever came up that you would actually need to consult with them.
Right, we have an, they charge cities an assessment every year, so take, we pay an assessment to do that.
Take advantage of it. As committee members, you can take advantage of it, just like council members or anyone else who's a city employee or city volunteer.
All right. Are you, any more questions? Because David is going to meet me back here at 5:30.
So, David, let me ask you a question on the actual conflict of interest. The example they give here is confusing because I thought actual conflict of interest actually talked about gain of money personally, that your action somehow benefits you personally. But the example they gave here is that the action of the mother actually benefited the son.
Yeah, I mean, so if you look at what the
But the person making the vote didn't actually benefit financially.
Well, it applies. I was being, you know, kind of direct to the committee members. But it's a relative or a business you're associated with, and they have a list of what relatives would be within that umbrella of what you'd have to be considered. So yeah, it's not, and obviously that's why you want to be aware of what relatives actually are listed in the statute as those that are connected with you, as far as if you make a decision, it would benefit them. And then obviously it would be a conflict of interest potential, obviously, with respect to you, as well as any business you're associated with. So yeah, that's it's a kind of a wider group than just you yourself. But I was using you as examples only because, you know, given how you operate at the airport, you know, many of you either lease your own hangar, so it would be directly related to what you're doing at the airport.
Well, that list of relatives is quite expansive. It's on page 7 of your handout. It says, relative means one of the following: the spouse, parent, step-parent, child sibling, step-sibling, son-in-law or daughter-in-law of the public official or candidate, the parent, step-parent, child sibling, step-sibling, son-in-law or daughter-in-law of the spouse of the public official or candidate, and any individual for whom the public official or candidate has legal support, any individual for whom the public official provides benefits arising from the public official's employment, and any individual from whom the public official or candidate receives benefits arising from the individual's employment. It's a pretty wide-ranging list.
And the other component of it is household members as well. So, for instance, if someone is renting a room from you, or someone's, you know, a housemate, doesn't have to be a spouse, just someone living with you in your household, that's a household member for purposes of these conflict of interest disclosures and requirements. So it's a fairly expansive list that everyone should be aware of. But again, for purposes of this airport committee, primarily it's based on what I know about the committee members. It's typically something that one of you as committee members are doing at the airport, either leasing or renting property, which then would pertain to what you have to be aware of. But if you had a relative that was leasing property at the airport or a household member, then you would have to be cognizant of these issues as well.
Okay, are we ready to move on?
Yep.
And thank you, Peggy, and thank you, David. And
so,
I'm leaving, David.
Yeah. What's the item you want me to stick around for?
I was going to ask if anyone had an objection to moving item 4F. It's the checklist for the lease.
I don't have a copy of it in front of me, so I really can't refer to it at this point.
We'll get you one. It's free.
Get me a copy.
Okay.
You got a copy?
Does anybody have an objection to moving 4F up in front of 4A?
I make that recommendation, Chair.
Okay, and lastly, based on David's earlier statement, does anyone have any agenda items to add to this meeting at this point? Okay, having said that, the final timeline checklist, that was item 4F on your agenda, will be the next item on the agenda, and we'll proceed with that. And I have some comments and concerns about that. And before I go, would anyone else like to precede me?
Because you're on 4F now?
Yes. Well, hearing none, I'll go ahead, and this may raise some thoughts in your own minds. And I'll just go through it page by page, but the big issue's on the last page. Just a little bit of a sidebar here. We talk about the airport rules and regulations. We have never approved the final rules. Is that true? You know, we went through a whole exercise here about a year ago, and I don't think they ever got to council.
It did not.
I don't think it needs to go for it.
No, it doesn't.
Okay, well, just something to think about. That's not the primary issue here. So the bigger issue here, well, a couple things. I'll just go down them in order. Insurance, liability insurance. I question whether you can obtain insurance for a structure when the design of the structure has not been finalized, because it requires, I know it's already in the lease.
Where are you looking at, Ralph?
What's that on the second page, about two-thirds of the way down?
Okay, I see it, okay.
Says you have to provide proof of liability insurance, naming the city as an additional insured, which is already in the lease anyway. But my question is, if you're in the construction phase, you can get construction insurance, but I'm not sure if you go down to an insurance agent, you can buy liability insurance on a structure yet to be built in which final approval hasn't been obtained.
I got it.
And I think that needs to be thought about.
Yeah.
Two paragraphs further down, we give the lessee 1 year to complete construction after approval. Well, if it stays in the form that it currently is, that approval could only take 3 more months, which would be, you only have 9 months to complete it. And I believe the current city code for normal building permits allows 2 years, and that in itself is not enforced. So is there a reason we want to make it what's effectively 9 months in this?
So you're saying 1 year, but you're taking away the, 3 months?
Well, if we stay with the 12-week, which I object to, and
okay,
I'll get to that.
Approval. So I guess what I'm trying to, because again, this was a group process with several staff, Lance and some other staff members. So what you're saying is that 1 year should basically be 1 year as a standalone and not, you know, be lessened by the prior timelines.
Well, yes, not lessened by approvals, but also, like I say, to be consistent with other city policies. I believe if you look up in the code, unless it's been changed, when you get a building permit, you know, irregardless of the airport, you get 2 years to completion, and I happen to know that's never been enforced, so
okay,
that's something
I'm just,
to look at.
I can pass that on, and I'm not the one, obviously, that's making decisions on this one.
I think the intent there, Ralph, is not to have an unfinished building standing around.
Well, I understand what the intent was, but we need to be consistent.
Could you do it? You could also put something in there to the extent that once construction starts, they have a certain period of time to complete it.
Yeah, I can. We can.
You know,
we can.
Well, why would that be different than a structure in the city of Newport? I mean, why couldn't it be 2 years? I mean, enforce the same code.
Like I said, I'll pass this on and see what the folks that actually do the building permits, what they say about it, since that's not my...
Yeah, I don't think we're going to... And it's getting late.
I'm writing the notes. I'm writing down the questions.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Go to the third page. And I think the big issue here is... well, before you get to the big issue, let me hit a couple other things. Halfway down the page, it says the lessee will provide documentation to different city departments on the fire and the there was one other one, the
fire suppression permits.
You know, the city should be capable of interdepartmental communication without their customer having to take care of interdepartmental communication. That obviously isn't a huge issue, but it seems logical that that should happen that way. Other thing on there, it requires the lessee to do the survey of the property. Well, the lessee cannot do the survey of the property unless the city provides the initial property definitions, setback requirements, et cetera, to the lessee. So the city has to be specified in there that the city's going to provide that data. I know that's already come up as an issue in real world here. So that should be included. And now getting to the big issue, I think, on this, I think you have a reasonable process until you get to step five. And what this, when I read this, and maybe I read it wrong, if I were really smart, I'd be a lawyer. But it seems to me you go through the process up till step five, and by the end of step four, you have a lease. You supposedly have a signed lease. The council's approved the lease. And then after all that's done, it goes to community development for their approval and other departments' approval. Well, I would never, and I don't think anybody that really thought about it, would ever sign a lease when they didn't know what those approvals were going to entail. I want to know if I can build the structure that I want to build before I sign the lease. I don't want to be stuck with a 15-year lease and not be able to complete the structure that I envisioned. So I think either the final signatures on the lease should be held until those approvals, those complete reviews are obtained, or that there is a clause in the lease that nullifies the lease for lack of agreement on the approval process. And I think that that's a fairly significant issue, because there's one line in there specifically that would scare me a whole lot if I was building something, and that's the penultimate paragraph on that page. It says, leasee will obtain any required reviews for impact on project stormwater erosion and any other reviews deemed necessary by the city of Newport. That's just completely open-ended. And so I would never sign up for an open-ended, they can do what they want and tell me later. So I would never sign the lease until, you know, I knew what those other things were. And I think that really needs to be addressed. And lastly, I think 12 weeks is excessive. I think the community development departmental reviews ought to take place within that 30 days that was specified up in the fourth section. 12 weeks is excessive. I know there's exceptions. There's always going to be exceptions, but I think the whole thing ought to be set back and put, say, the whole process is done within 30 days and then the lease is signed. In other words, include step five into step four and make it 30 days.
It's been taking quite a bit of time, Ralph, to get things through cities and counties right now.
That's not really the issue.
Well,
here.
That's because they're so busy. I mean,
I understand, but that's not the issue here.
Yeah.
Well, if the city needs more staff or less staff or doesn't have enough budget, that's your problem as a council. But I think as a step process review, it ought to be done within 30 days.
So a lot of your questions and issues, Ralph, are going to have to run through the community development department. I mean, that's kind of what your focus is on. So I'll just pass those along and.
Yeah, like I say, I didn't expect a resolution today, but I don't.
No, I'm saying that's kind of where I'm going to have to send these, and then I guess.
There's also a separation. You have to separate. You're doing a land lease, right? You're not doing a building lease, so you have to separate out what is the land lease and what's a building. So.
But why would you sign the land lease if you couldn't build the building?
Well, a lot of people lease land before they get the building designed and constructed.
I'll see what the development department has to say about this.
If it
actually, like I said, if it looks like there's some discussion that has to, you know, occur, we'll see how we want to handle this. Right now, this is what you've raised some issues that need to be looked at, you know, as far as the insurance and some other things, but some of these other issues, as far as step five goes, that's really, you know, for the development department to take a close look at and see what they have to say about it.
Where did this document actually come from, Ralph? Do you know?
Say again, Timor.
Where did this document come from? Do you know? Where did this document come from?
I can explain that. So, Timor, this document came. This document was developed because prior to this document, when a land lease was entered into and someone wanted to build a box hangar, there was a process, but it wasn't really formalized. That wasn't really written down in one document. So in hearing that over the course of the past year or so, staff, meaning city manager, city recorder, lands, development director, I weighed in on a number of issues. We tried to find out what all these different steps were and the timelines associated with them that led to not just the land lease, but the actual completion of the hangar. And this is what we came up with. I think we ran this by the airport committee a couple of meetings ago, and they provided some comments. We passed those comments on to staff. So this is really work. This is really putting into writing what kind of was in an informal process over the years that needed to actually be more well-documented.
Yeah, the goal is commendable, and we need to do it. And I think it's good, but I think we need to adjust some of the parameters and put some boundaries around some of the issues.
So just to kind of close this conversation, I got your issues, unless there's any other ones right now from other committee members, and I'll pass those on, and we'll see what our staff has to say about some of the things you've brought up, and either Lance or someone else can get back to the committee as far as how we want to address those.
Okay, is there any other comments on that item? All right, hearing none, we'll go on to...
Thanks, Ralph.
Item 4B. Thanks, David.
Thanks. I'm going to be heading out, but thanks for your time, and hope this was helpful today.
Okay. I'd like to make one comment. Sorry, I didn't unmute. Am I too late?
No, we're always...
Are you guys, you got... Hey, on the leasee, we'll provide documentation from a surveyor showing the site is property stake. Is that how we've done this in the past, or is that something new?
That I don't know, because this is really the first time I got involved is when we were developing this. Who's
Dan,
more familiar with this process to actually know how that's proceeded?
Lance, I don't think anything's been built out there in so long that anybody really knows, unless Lance knows. But like I say, regardless of how you go at it, you know, the city is definitely, if they don't do the whole survey job, they're at least going to have to provide the initial boundaries and requirements.
I guess the question was, how has it been done in the past? And if it was done differently, why are we changing it? And I don't have the answer to that because I'm not familiar with what happened in the past.
Well, we did try to...
Let me...
From the same standpoint, when I was working with one of the hangar owners who first was building out there, I could not get a surveyor to come out and do a survey because it was too large of a site for the entire airfield from where the... I guess the surveying site markers are set. I couldn't find a surveyor that would be willing to come out and do that. So we took it upon ourselves to go out and just kind of measure out and stake and then tweak from there where lots might be, because don't have a surveyor come and do it, and we got to move the process forward.
We'll look into it.
So let me give you just a little bit of how I've seen this done in the past. Typically, the airport master plans, if it's very organized, it actually kind of sets what buildings will be where, how far apart they'll be from each other, and what size they'll be for different areas. In the past, when I've built hangars at different airports, the city actually has staked the corners of the building. That was not up to me to get a surveyor to do that. They wanted to keep everything organized, and they wanted to control that. So they actually set those corner boundaries to get somebody to come out there to a leasee to go out there and get a surveyor. I don't know. It seems like we might have some trouble with still not getting the buildings put where we want them unless we set the corners.
That's been my experience in two other airports that I was involved with building hangars also.
Okay. That was good. Take a look at it. Thanks.
Is that it, Dan?
That's all I got. Thank you.
Okay, right. Let's move on to item 4B. Lystra Hangar Design, and Lance.
All right. Item 4B is Doug Lystra's hangar design for leased site A4. Recommendation would be an approval of the submitted design for site hangar A4. Mr. Lystra is submitting this hangar design for committee approval for the lease site A4. During March 15, 2022, airport committee meeting, Mr. Lystra lease for A4 was recommended to City Council, which then was approved. I do have actually a larger drawing if anybody would like to look at it, but he's proposing a very modest hangar in that site A4 due to lack of room. I can barely read that. Does anybody want to see the larger rolled out design?
I'm good.
I don't want to see the design, but I have a question for you because I can't read it either. And my question is, how wide is the hangar? It's 50. The dimension I can read is 50, but the front has a jog, you know, where it sticks out on the east side there. And which I don't really care about that, but I know that you guys were trying to maintain some distance in there for fire equipment. Are we still okay with that, or am I incorrect in that statement?
I'm not sure about maintaining distance for fire equipment to get in there. They should be able to get in there fine. The hangar width right now is at 62 feet with that jog, but the back part of it is only 50 feet. The total length is going to be 48.
48, okay. So, I like I said, maybe I was just incorrect. I thought you were trying to keep those 10 feet apart, but if that's incorrect, that's fine.
I think it was 10 feet apart based on what the building code was for having to, like, dual sheetrock and all that other items that came up with a couple of the other hangers.
Okay, so we don't need to maintain the 10 feet to the fence?
No.
No, because that's a ravine on the other side of the fence, so I don't think a fire truck would go back there anyways.
Very good. Well, I wasn't thinking. Thank
one,
you, Lance.
One comment I'd make on this design and actually the other design we're also looking at here today is that I noticed both, I believe both of them had 10-foot high doors. And I mean, that's fine with me. I don't care if that's what they want to build. I'm just thinking down the road, there's several aircraft that won't fit into a 10-foot high door that would still fit into a 40-foot wide door. And, you know, 10 and a half or 11 might be an option. Most hangars, most T-hangars, commercial hangars you buy now are all 12-foot, but it's just something for the people to think about. That's all, the applicants.
So do I have a motion or recommendation from the committee for approval for the design?
I'll go ahead and make a motion to approve Doug Lister's design.
Do I hear a second?
I'll second it.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Okay, it's approved. Let's go on to the next one.
Just a second here, I'm catching up.
For Jim Seavers.
All right, so item 4C is Jim Seavers hangar design for leased site J. Mr. Seavers has submitted his hangar design for the committee approval for leased of site J. During the March 15th, 2022 airport committee meeting, Mr. Seavers' lease for site J was recommended to City Council, which was approved during the April 4th, 2022 meeting. This picture did come out a little bit better. So for site J, Mr. Seavers is proposing a 56-foot wide front, of course, that to hold the doors for the one side. It'll be 38 feet long and then 48 feet long in the back.
Comments? Motion to approve?
I also want to make note that little front stub is, he put that in there, I think, to keep the hangars pretty much consistent, that little facade on the front ends. I'm not too sure if that's going to stay there or not, but the point being is he wanted to keep everything consistent with all the other hangars, you know, on that property there. So well, having said that, I'll go ahead and make a motion that we approve Jim Seavers' renditions.
Second? Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Okay, it's approved. And Lance, question on that, did you apply for the pencil change to the plan to get that site as a show?
Yes, we're gonna run that the same time as a 7460, which for this site and for Lystra's hangar site have both been submitted, just waiting for review, of course. So
okay.
Hopefully it'll be pretty quick and steady because we've been sending a lot up to the FAA recently. So,
are these two separate hangars?
Yes.
Yeah, two different places. One's
yeah,
on the south
side,
one's on the west.
From the information, that the ground shot is on Seavers' hangar. It looks like it's Lystra site. Am I reading that wrong?
Yes. Unless somebody has a typo in there. Seavers is the one on the west side.
Yeah, this is.
Yeah, that's Hangar J you're looking at, Councilor Goble.
Site.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, by the fence here. Yeah, but but then they're saying this is the number.
Oh, here. Sorry, no, that red spot was for a future. I haven't updated that North Hangar area yet. That future spot has been taken, the number four spot, Councilor Goble, by the gentleman from Montana, who's currently building a hangar in there, and Site J will actually go just to north of Hangar K.
It's a new site.
So I do need to update that map. I just haven't had a minute to do it, but Mr. Shaw has a map there for you on the side.
Okay. I'm just checking.
Okay, let's move on to the North Development First Concept, Lance.
Okay, so the North Development First Concept, this is kind of a first look as 9 additional of the buildings could fit a 35-foot high roof peak, which adds 3 50-by-50 hangars and 2 60-by-60 hangars, and 1 100-by-100 hangar and 3 80-by-80 hangars. One building not taller than 25 has a 25-foot peak height roof, including an additional 19 tie-downs with aprons and taxi lanes going into those areas. So if you look at the picture, the rendering on the second page, I know it's a little bit difficult. It's off of a topography map, but you can see runway 16, just a little bit above that is taxiway Alpha. You can see the defines of 2 dark outlines of taxi lanes going up to an area where an apron could be put in, along with the 35-foot build line restriction line. And then the Part 77 air surface 500 offset from the runway center line as well. Kind of a first idea. Does the committee have any different thoughts or ideas or questions, I guess?
I guess the one question I have is, I guess that's as far east as we can effectively build because of the height limit. And that's all well and good. Do you think we should have, and this is a question, I have no opinion one way or the other, but do you think we should be specifying hangar sizes or just say this area is available? I mean, somebody could come in and say, well, I want to build 300 by 100 hangars, or, you know, I want to build 5 50 by 50s, and it, you know, it doesn't meet what we have on the plan, or do we want to actually specify this thing or just leave it as a notional idea?
Is this a fire hall?
No, because you'd have to have front and back access to be effective for a T hanger, so I doubt that would work.
Oh, nesting hangers.
Yes.
Got it.
I'm not hearing a lot of opinion here.
So I think it would be, you know, we don't really have a lot of people, you know, knocking down the door to develop up there. I think one of the things that was brought up was potentially splitting out like turbine traffic from piston traffic and potentially having this area for turbine type aircraft, which would be your larger aircraft, larger wingspan and stuff. And that way it would keep it kind of away from the smaller piston aircraft. So I think it would really be kind of up to the committee. If I have somebody, you know, interested in maybe doing a full design of the whole outlay or doing individual spots, is that something that the committee wants to take up on a case-by-case basis? Or do we want to say, you know, I'm kind of maybe leery if somebody wants to build the 100-foot building or a big building, or they want to do that and lease out. I think that would be something the committee should take under recommendation, because that would eat up a lot of those spots. But I guess it would be dependent on what the recommendation from the committee might be.
Dan, do you have a copy of this document, Dan?
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now.
Well, quite honestly, you have more experience at airport development than any of us. I'm just kind of anxious to hear your input on this.
You know, I think we want to kind of control what goes there. I think we want to do a section of, like, if you want to do the 50 by 50s, that's fine, and do that as a section. The only thing I don't want to get too involved in is if you have an area that you've set to be 100 by 100, and then somebody wants to build a 60 by 60, and then it kind of throws everything off. What we the last place I was, we had an area for the big hangars, and then we had an area that we did as 50 by 50s. So every hangar in there was a 50 by 50, and everything was very uniform, and it fit very nice, and it was a good use of space. And then we had an area where we had, you know, you'd have maybe like an FBO or somebody that had a 100 by 100 hangar or had a reason to have that. You know, the drawing that's here, I think it looks, I mean, I think it's a pretty good concept. Maybe we want to, you know, take a little bit of time and look at this, you know, as a group a little bit better and, you know, instead of making a decision here and just kind of work with this a little bit. I don't know. What do you guys think?
No, they could still be the anchor tenant at one of those 80 by 80s, but originally we were going to put them down by the Coast Guard, but that did not pan out, so we could potentially put them up north if they ever decide to do build a hangar in this area. Maybe they... No, originally we wanted them by the Coast Guard, but that didn't... Yeah.
Well, I think the idea and the work that's been done here by the engineers is good, and now we've got an idea approximately where we can build. Like I say, the exact number of buildings and the sizes, I think, well, we're open to proposals.
Yeah, the sizes of building could vary. I mean, you could have somebody like Dan, like somebody can come in and want to put, you know, 4 or 5 50 by 50s, and then that would eat up a little bit of space, and we just send it back to the engineers and say, what would now fit. I mean, there's even the 25-foot build line, which means your peak height can't be higher than 25 feet. So I'm not, you know, that you could have smaller hangars, I guess, in that area is what I'm going at. You could do a little bit more with a little bit different building size, but it's really up to the committee what they would, you know, want.
What's the height of the, like our T-hanger out there, that's what, about 20?
I think that's like 18 or 19 feet. So yeah,
you
right
could actually
20.
Put T-hangers out there where you got tie-downs shown.
Yeah, you could. If you remove those tie-downs, we could have room for a section of 10 T-hangers.
Well, but depends on what you put behind them. You know, when I get my Gulfstream, I'm going to need a lot of room.
Okay, Ralph.
Well, that's very true. It depends on the you can put anything you want on here as long as you have enough room to get the airplane through, right?
And I think that's what Dan was referencing, is this is a good start, but we want to make sure that, you know, we want to make good use of that property, for aircraft storage.
All right. Well, where do we go from here? Just leave it as a concept at this point?
I guess leave it as a concept maybe at this point. And if anybody, you know, wants to start developing in that area, I'll have them come before the committee to do a presentation. And then I think it would leave it up to the committee's recommendation. Like if somebody wants to come in and do, you know, 80 by 80s, or they say, hey, I like this and I want to do this, I definitely would have them come before the committee to make a presentation on that for developing, because there's going to be a lot more involved in that than I think would be like for what we did with any of the current hangars.
Yeah, perfect. There's no concrete out there now, is there? It's just bare dirt, isn't it? Any what?
It's just bare dirt, right?
Yeah, and there's a lot of earth moving that needs to be done to get that ready.
Yeah, and I think the other thing would be the apron. If somebody wants to come in and do that, they'd probably have to be talked with administration about the use of that apron and what type of, you know, that's way beyond my department, obviously. So
it's certainly not ready to be out there.
Lance,
go ahead, Ken.
Hey, wasn't that the area that the potential for the sewer line was going to go through?
Well, the ARF building is up there closer to the top, and then Highway 101. It was my understanding that the sewer line would follow the highway, the public access on Highway 101 up there, because that's where one of the intertines is at. But if the sewer line does go through there, I would think that would be probably a better selling point for buildings to potentially hook up to that.
Right. And who would pay for the concrete and the asphalt better?
That is what I think would need to be worked out with administration and city council, because ultimately I think the idea would be to keep those as a public tie-down area for people like potentially if somebody wants to put in a jet center, we'll say, as that concept, I think those tie downs would want to be open to anybody who can get in that or want to go up there, which means then it would also therefore be public property. So if somebody wants to build that asphalt in there, and maybe that's part of the in-kind type thing, is not being charged for the lease of that land or something, that would have to be worked out, you know, at a different level than what I am right here.
I think the FAA will still provide grant money for ramp space. They will not provide money for hangars or hangar floors at this point.
I believe that is also something they would do. What we should probably do is potentially maybe submit this for a pen and ink change to the FAA so that we don't have to trudge through that. If the committee is open to that, we can submit this design, or if you guys want to think about it and consider it, you know, over the next few weeks and come back with some other ideas, or have me submit some ideas to the engineering department before we do a pen and ink change to the master plan. But I think that would probably be the best route to go, is get it on our master, our airport layout plan.
Why don't you put it on the agenda for, like, say, 2 months from now, and then, you know, we'll have a follow-up.
Okay.
And while we're adding agenda items for, let's say, next month, let's put the animal shelter back on the agenda for next month, if everybody's okay with that. Having said all that, let's move on to the entrance sign.
Due to the sake of time at our meeting, Mr. Chair, I'd like to table that till next meeting.
Out of here pretty soon.
I'm starting to run time also.
What was the last comment?
What was that, Kenny?
I said I'm starting to run out of time also.
I got to 4:40 because I got to get a COVID.
Well, we could make this the last agenda item, and we can skip the operations reports. There's not a whole lot of interesting things in there as usual.
Oh no, there's interesting things there.
I'd like to make a recommendation that we stick with the operations report and just table this sign till next meeting.
Do we have a consensus on tabling the sign?
Yes.
Yes.
I agree.
Okay, consider it tabled. We have I don't know if that needs to be a motion, but
we just made it.
Oh, it's a consensus. I think that's fine.
It's a consensus motion.
Yes.
If there is such a thing.
Okay.
There's no consensus motion.
And Lance, if you can go ahead and buzz through the operations report at high speed, we'll.
I think in the interest of time, we can all read Lance's report. Maybe he could just highlight the things that we need to know about that are most important.
That's what I was getting toward.
Jumped the gun here.
No worries. So of course for the February report, there was the planning commission, which then was appealed, and the decision was made at city council during the last city council meeting to grant the conditional use permit for the animal shelter. Participated in the ODA SOAR ARC committee for review of some SOAR grants. There was a department head strategic planning event that I attended. We're in the budget season as usual. Don't have a lot of items that I'm asking for. And then right now, currently working on getting the Kubota up and running. It came back from the shop, and our implement for that, the 20-foot mower deck, won't be in until August. So when I hooked up the 5-foot mower deck, there was a small crack on one of the rear rings that blew out one of the seals. So I have all the parts in. I just need to get that up and running. The self-serve unit mascot's been out a couple of times now. They finally figured out with Fuel Master that the last board that they need is on order and will be in shortly or soon, I should hope, so that we can get that self-serve up and running. Currently, it's been going smoothly with pilots calling ahead of time and and arranging for fueling. So that's not too bad.
Lance, can I interrupt for a second? I want to follow up on that automatic 10% shutoff valve that is malfunctioning on the inside. What's the status of that as well?
So we're going to have to wait for that the fuel suction to get lower. Once it gets to that stop point, then I can remove the back of that clock, basically, is what it is. There's a steel cable that runs on a wind that I don't know if the steel cable is long enough for what the suction is. I think that's what's holding it up, because when you pull on the steel cable, you can feel it on the end. You can feel there's a bunch of weight on the end, which I believe is the floating suction head itself. So I think that's preventing it from going any further. So that I got to wait for the tank basically to be at a point when we can put the 700 gallons back in it after it hits that shutoff, so I can adjust it and see if we can get it going again.
And you're fairly confident that you can repair this thing, or should this be on Monarch because it's their installation?
Well, it is their installation, but it's a single screw on the back that you unscrew, and then it should release tension on the pulley to allow the pulley to move further. But the only thing I don't know is that if there's more string on that pulley to move out, or if not, then I can just disconnect it.
Okay, just make sure we have fuel ready to go.
Yes, we will. We will let you know ahead of time. They must have not been here, because it's been a lot longer than 5 weeks. It's interior silicone computer chips that have gone out in it. In the original FMU, instead of replacing it, now we're replacing every single computer chip through the whole thing, and that's just the holdup is the time to get the parts in and find the parts for it. So that's it.
I move we adjourn the meeting. Any objections?
None here.
Okay, meeting's adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
You always want to do that, didn't you, Judge?
Might show on the website.